I wished you'd have told me what I said was so profound so I could repeat it. I'd have wrote it down if you told me. I have a damn announcement here. I don't know why the Hyatt manager gives me announcements to make. The Hyatt management asked me to make this announcement. It says that in case of fire, the Al-Anons are to remain seated until the AAs have cleared. I didn't say that, honey. That was the manager of the Hyatt. My name's Jack Sullivan. I'm an alcoholic. I come from Louisville, Kentucky. My sobriety date in AA is the 21st day of August of 1962. My home group is the South Louisville group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets on Wednesday night up in Louisville. It's an open speaker meeting. And I hope if you ever in the city or come through the city, you'll stop by and see us. I think it's the finest home group in the world. If you don't have a home group, I suggest you get one. And if you got one and you don't think yours is the finest in the world, then my advice to you is just stay there. Don't go screw up somebody else's. You're probably right where you belong. But I am glad to be here, and I appreciate Diane and her committee inviting Gay and I to come down and be with you this weekend. It's a lot of fun, and that's what AA is all about. And I was blessed that I grew up in an era of people that they understood that they don't take yourself so damn seriously, and if you just quit putting self-inflicted wounds on you, you'll do pretty good in this program as long as you stay here and work the steps. And I've learned that over the years, and I try to do it every day. And it's a blessed opportunity for us to get reacquainted with some of our old friends and to make new ones. And that's what these things are all about. I mean, you know, I don't know if any of these other people have ego problems with us, but I'm here to assure you I don't. You hear somebody talk on occasion, that guy's a Saturday night speaker. What the hell difference does it make if you're the Saturday morning speaker? I mean, or they'll say the Sunday morning speaker is a spiritual speaker. I resent the hell out of that. I have a little spirituality. I know in AA, it's a funny organization. They don't do like the animal kingdom. In the animal kingdom, they devour the young. In AA, they devour the old. You have somebody like our friend Kara with 3 months sobriety. Some guy gets up there with 40 years and they give him a $25 gift certificate to Dr. Kevorkian. You're much better off. Trust me. She's 3 months sober and already corrupting Al-Anon. She took my wife shopping today. But anyway, I thank you all for having us. I hope you don't get tired. I know you've been sitting for a long time, and it's not my fault. And when you're out in the lobby bitching, don't include me. I didn't have anything to do with it. I have a philosophy about talking. When I came here tonight, I knew it was going to. You came in, you knew you were going to listen. If you get through before I do, you go on home. It will not bother me in the least. I'll try to do the best I can here. I'll share some stories with you. I don't believe in telling jokes from the podium. Any story I tell you will be true. I don't believe in lying behind the podium. They tell me if you lie when you're up here talking, all your hair will fall out. Look at Fred. Fred's got a lot of faith, though. He carries a comb in his pocket. I mean, you can't do much better than that. Well, I've certainly enjoyed everybody that I've heard. This is a fascinating thing, and I'm very serious when I say this, and I told Diane this, that I've never been anywhere, and I've been around a little while, where you could take a convention like this and use mostly local speakers, and they were all terrific. I mean, they were. Yeah, I'm serious. You know, and there's a few of us foreigners up here sharing, but it was just great. And I enjoyed that old-timers panel. He wouldn't let me on it. I'm 41 days short. I tried to borrow 40 days from Charlie Linden, and he wouldn't give them to me, so I couldn't get on the 35-year deal, you know. But God, I love those old-timers and those guys that were brought into my life. One of my favorite heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody has heroes, and everybody has legends in AA. And if you're from California or Texas or Oklahoma or Florida, wherever you are, there's always somebody around that's been a legend. You know, they've just been people that it gladdens your heart and lightens your eyes to have had the privilege over the years to have known them. You know, and it's so great. It's just so great. And one of my favorite old guys was old Wino Joe Leach. And if you have never heard of Wino Joe, there's a taper over there, and you ought to get one and listen, because he's one of the great simplistic AA members that ever lived. I mean, he had a deal that wouldn't quit, and my life was blessed having been his friend and crossed his path. And I remember one time when those 20 questions you see around everywhere that ask you if you're an alcoholic, I think they were written by some psychologist in John Hopkins University. And when Joe saw those questions, he got madder than hell. And he wanted to know who wrote them, and somebody told him, and Joe said, "What in the hell is a psychologist doing writing questions asking us if we're alcoholics? An alcoholic ought to write questions asking you if you're alcoholic." And so Joe wrote some. And he had about 8 of them, and I remember one of them is, "Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburn?" "Have you ever been arrested while in jail?" "Mm-hmm." "Ever been run over by your own car while driving?" Mm-hmm. Probably the best one of them all, that Joe said, "If you were an alcoholic, if you have mastered the art of puking out of a moving vehicle without it blowing back in on you." Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about standing here telling you that and looking at the people that are out there going, "Bleh." They're identified, you know. but those guys were the greatest old guys in the world, and very truthful men. I don't know many alcoholics that lie. I've heard there are some, but I just don't know them. I get really upset with my wife. I used to. She was, I could understand occasionally if she wanted to accuse me of lying. But she's had the audacity to accuse our state delegate of lying. And I couldn't believe that she would do that. We had a fellow up there named Billy Moore, and Billy Moore would share stories with me that were true. And I know they were true because he was a state delegate. And Gay thought he lied. Well, I'll ask you to use your judgment. Billy Moore told me about a lady he knew one time who was a member of the Al-Anon family group. Now, Brutus, don't look at me that way. And Billy Moore said this lady's husband kept bouncing in and out of AA, and he finally died, and he was drinking, and he died. And after he died, she had him cremated, and she mixed his ashes with some marijuana and smoked him. And she went all over the country telling people that's the first time in 25 years that sucker ever made her feel good. And that's a true story because Billy Moore told it to me. Billy said he knew that woman personally, and I believe him. I'd like to thank the gentleman here that's interpreter. You get an interpreter here for people that can't hear. It'd be nice if you had one on the other end for people that won't listen. Maybe next year you can bring one of them in. We could use another one of them, I believe. But I come from Louisville, Kentucky. I was born and raised there, and I tell you that because for me that's proper English. I made that statement one night at a hospital anniversary meeting, and my stepmother and father were in the audience, and my stepmother said to me, "Don't do that behind the podium. That's not good English. Try to use the proper English when you're speaking to an audience." She said, "Don't tell people you were born and raised. Tell them you were born and reared." She said, "Anything that's raised has absolutely no intelligent form of life. And my father looked at her and said, leave him alone. He knows what the hell he's talking about. So I tell you, I was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. I came from a family of four. I have an older brother and two younger sisters. And to my knowledge, there wasn't any alcoholism in the family. My brother developed a problem later on in life and after he'd gotten up in his 50s. But my father was a good man. My mother was a very sickly lady. I never remember my mother being well. She died of a rare blood disease when I was about 18, 19 years old. But ever since I'm old enough to remember, she'd had problem with that blood infection, and she just had never been a well lady at all. She's not a part of my story. My father is. My father was a very wonderful man, and my father could have belonged to Al-Anon, or he could have started Al-Anon. He was the type of a guy that didn't believe in paying for you. If you wanted to dance to the music, you pay the fiddler. I'll not pay for you. My father believed that if you're looking for a helping hand, it's on the end of your own arm. And he lived for 8 years of my sobriety and deeply regretted the fact that I never knew where to put my arm. And neither did he. And my father and I became bitter enemies over my conduct and my drinking and my behavior patterns. And we didn't have much use for each other until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he dearly loved AA. And dearly loved my sponsor and all the people that he'd met and knew in here. And during that course of 8 years, my father and I became the very best of friends. And we could talk about anything, and we could laugh and cry about the days of yesteryear. And it was a great relationship. And I thank God every day that my father lived in my sobriety. I know a lot of my friends and probably a lot of you who have had to go to cemeteries sometimes and try to make peace within your heart of the turmoil that was created in your life and the person that passed away before you had a chance to find this program. And I was blessed in that area that my father did live for 8 years, my sobriety. I went to Catholic school in the first 8 years I was in school. I never really recall ever having any affiliation with God. I don't remember having any kind of a feeling for that type of belief or things. And I was always under the impression that God was one of them condemning, scorekeeping type of people that told you thou shalt not and you were going to hell unless you did. And it was a very damning thing. And I believed that most of my life. And a friend of mine, Walter, is here tonight, and he heard me say this in Tampa. And Walter had been sober for 20 years, he said, when I said that night. And I was sitting in an audience one night sober 22 years, I think, and all my sobriety in AA, I had still believed that about my childhood, you know. And I heard a speaker one night say the very same thing I just told you, that that's what I was taught in school and that's what I was taught in church about God. And the speaker said, I'm not real sure that's what they said. I'm only sure that's what I heard. And I'm not real sure that's what they said. I'm only sure that's what I heard. And so I never really had any involvement in that, although I was a good kid. I don't know of anything to tell you about my life up to the time I was 15, 16 years old and a sophomore in high school. And I had a good home. It crossed my mind when all those other programs began to flit around AA 10 or 12 years ago that make you a victim. Something, you know, I've always personally believed there's no such thing in AA as a victim. There's a hell of a lot of volunteers. But it does make you think. It takes some of the responsibility off of it. You can blame it on somebody else. I'm sober 20 years, and I got to thinking about that. I made a telephone call to South Carolina to a friend of mine out there, sober longer than I am. And I said, Brian, I needed to talk to you. I said, I've been thinking. And he said, I'm sorry to hear that. I said, you know, do you reckon I could have came from a dysfunctional home? He said, were you in it? Yeah. And I said, of course I was in it. He said, you bet if you was in it, it's dysfunctional. Well, that ended that part of the story. Yeah. And I've never gotten back into any of that, and I've never really understood why other people do. I know sometimes it's popular to be an alcoholic and a something. I don't know why they won't bring it in. AA's given all those people their philosophy, their steps, and it's worked for everybody, overeaters, narcotics, gamblers, anonymous. Well, it hadn't worked for everybody. It worked for everybody but prostitutes. Those steps did not work for Prostitutes Anonymous. It, it worked for a little while, but when they got to that part that said in order to keep it, you got to give it away. That kind of went downhill a little bit after that. But I have an old friend who was in AA for a while, and he finally went off up into the mountains, and he kind of became a loner up that way, and he stayed up there for a few years, and he came back to AA, and he said to me one day, "Boy, AA's really changed since I've been gone." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You know," he said, "when I was younger, all them homes had a basement in them. Said, we used to do a lot of drinking in the basement. And now they do a lot of drinking in the attic." I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "Everywhere I go, there's people up there drinking in attics." He said, "They all say they're an alcoholic in the attic." I said, "You need to listen just a little bit more closely, you know." But anyway, when I was about 15, 16 years old, World War II was just about over. Just to share with you in a general way what happened to me. And my life had been pretty normal up to that time. And I got a job in Louisville, Kentucky, out at a corner of 3rd and Central. Now, 3rd and 4th and Central is a very popular corner in Louisville, much more so than it is now. But one of the reasons for it was Churchill Downs Racetrack borders that area. And if you've never been to Louisville, I'm sure most everybody's seen the Kentucky Derby on television. That's what it's famous for. The state of Kentucky is known for smooth whiskey, pretty women, and fast horses. And sometimes they get twisted around a little bit, but anyway, it works out pretty good. And I got out to that corner now, and I'm about 15, 16 years old, and there's not any money in my house. My mother's sickness took all my father's money, and we didn't have any money in our house, and I didn't know beans from apple butter about anything, and I was a pretty good kid in school, and I got out there at the corner working at night with an older boy, about 20 years old. But the interesting thing, somebody was talking about that today, everything was rationed. You couldn't buy a lot of things during World War II, and everything was rationed, including gasoline. But those people, some of the older people that didn't use all those ration coupons at the month, would come in that station at the end of the month, buy 3 or 4 gallons of gas, and give you a book. There might be 5 or 10 coupons. And what that meant was there's a lot of gasoline down in those tanks now that can be sold without that ration coupon. And there was guys around there that owned beer joints and liquor stores, and you couldn't buy that good stuff over the counter. But they had some of it, but didn't have any gas. And they'd come down there, and we'd fill those Cadillacs up, and they'd leave good whiskey, the old Fitzgerald and old Jack Daniels, and the good beer like Bud and Fall City Brewery was popular up home, and they'd leave that beer and whiskey there, and we'd fill their cars with gasoline. And we'd put that beer and whiskey in a storeroom, and we either drank it or sold it, and that's where I learned to drink. And there was a guy across the street who ran a drugstore, and he didn't have any gasoline, but he had good cigarettes, and you couldn't buy them over the counter, and he'd bring the cars over, we'd fill them with gas, he'd leave the Luckies and the Camels and the Chesterfields there, and we put them in a storeroom, and we either smoked them or sold them. That's where I learned to smoke. Yeah. And there were some girls out there that didn't have any gasoline, but you'll have to draw your own conclusions about that part of the story. But I'm 16 years old, and my whole life had completely changed. I was in an activity that I thoroughly enjoyed. I was drinking booze, I was smoking cigarettes, I was having sex, I had money in my pocket, and just an entirely different change in my life, and I loved every minute of it. And my brother had gotten a scholarship to GM Tech, and I was offered one, turned it down, he took it, and he went off to school, and just a couple of years later, both of my sisters had gotten married, and I was still out there in that environment and loving every bit. And my father and I went round and round. My dad did not like what I was doing, who I was with, where I was going, how long I was staying, and I didn't much give a damn what he liked or what he didn't like. And I developed an attitude where I resented discipline and I resented authority, and I didn't want anything to do with it, and I didn't want anybody interfering with me in what I wanted to do at the age of 16. You see it everywhere today. Yeah. Everywhere today with kids. Now, I don't know why you're like that, but some of us are. Now, and my father and I began our development of a father-son relationship that was really going astray. And my grades in school went down, and I was going to Catholic high school, and I finished my sophomore year there, and the principal sent for me one day and asked me not to come back. and I was not a drunk. The principal said, I don't like your attitude. There's something about you that's changed. I don't know what it is, and you don't want to talk about it, but I don't want you around here. Go somewhere else and finish your high school education. We don't need people like you that are disruptive and resentful at authority, and just go somewhere else and do it. And you know what I did? I told them, go to hell. Right, who needs you, baby? Story of my life. Who needs you? I don't need you. I didn't want to come back here anyway. And so I went home and told my dad, I'm not going back to St. X. I never did tell him. They asked me not to come back, but the principal had called him and asked him what was wrong with me. And my father said, I don't know. He's just changed. And he's made a decision about his own life that he's going to do what he wants to do when he wants to do it, and I can't stop him. And he said, I assume neither can you. So I went on my merry way and finished my high school education in a vocational school and hung around that corner and doing what they did and working a little bit and getting money and, you know, drinking booze, smoking cigarettes, having girls, and loving every damn minute of them. Didn't need nobody until I was 20. And then for the first time ever in my life, I was arrested for public intoxication and disorderly conduct. That alcohol itself had now begun to take a toll on me. And I was in jail. I had nobody to call except him. It's a fascinating thing how jails change our opinion of people. It really is. Did you ever go down to Carter Slough with some guy talk about that old bitch he lives with? Lock him up. He'll call and she'll answer and he'll say, honey, I was the same way. And I called my father. And I called and he answered and I said, Daddy? Oh, I can hear him as if it was tonight. He said, what do you want? I said, I'm in jail. He said, why in the hell did you call me? I said, well, I thought you might come down here and get me out. Oh, he said, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you.
Well,
I was worried about it. He said, as smart as you are, I'm sure that as smart as you are, you figured a way to get in, you will figure a way to get out. And he hung up. And when I got out and ran to him somewhere along the way one day, he said to me, I've never been in jail. I understand they give you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it. And I rambled on for another 13 years. And the rest was at 20, and I finally found Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 33. I tried everywhere in the world to live in that world out there with a little bit of peace of mind and serenity and happiness. And just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, every time I was sober, I became restless, irritable, and discontented. And I don't have to go into a long, lengthy psychological or psychiatric explanation for that kind of behavior and feelings. The big book adequately describes people like me. I wanted to be in that environment with those people doing what they were doing without paying a price for it. And I knew it was trouble, and I'd back away from it. You can't stay drunk all your life. And when I was away from it, I was just miserable as hell. I really and truly became restless, irritable, and discontented. And I wanted back in it, and eventually I would go. And eventually I would have to pay the price, and the older I got, the worse I got, and I don't have to tell you that. Alcoholics Anonymous would not have helped me before I got here. And I don't tell you that in a theoretical fashion. It's an absolute fact. And I'll tell you why I know it is. I was the type of person who could not learn from other people. I already knew it all. And AA says it's what you learn after you know it all that counts. But I just couldn't learn from other people. I was one of those people who literally demanded from the world that I have my own experiences. You couldn't share anything with me that meant anything. I said to a psychiatrist friend of mine one time, I said, wish to hell I was 18 years old again and know what I know now. And he said, when you were 18, somebody already knew it and you wouldn't listen to them. And was that the truth? And the young ones I sponsor today, that's exactly what I tell them. I can't do anything for you, baby, except tell you where you're going. And if you demand to have your own experiences, you just have to go do it. And I'll pray that God lets you live and you don't get maimed or incarcerated or go insane. But you got to have your own experience and go have them. And if some people come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can almost tell them. They have the capability to learn from others, and they apply that, and they stay here, and they do well. Not me. I could not learn from other people. I was telling Dr. Brown, a friend of mine, one day we were talking about this type of subject and people, and he shared a story with me, which I love, and I'll share it with you. He was telling me, we were talking about people who couldn't learn from others, and he was telling me about a lady that owned a Polly parrot. It was a filthy-mouthed bird, cussed all the time. She could do nothing with it. She got mad at the parrot one day and grabbed him by his feet and threw him in a freezer. And after a while, she felt sorry for the bird, opened the freezer, let him out. The bird's about froze to death. She looked at him and said, I get so damn disgusted with you and your filthy mouth. When will you ever learn to quit cussing? And the parrot said, I'll never cuss again as long as I live. He said, but tell me, what did that turkey do? Well, the parrot learned from the turkey. And I'm sure sitting in this room tonight with some of those newcomers, some of them oldcomers too, there's some parrots in here. There's some of you who will learn from other people and do well. I'm damn sure there's some turkeys sitting in here too. Yeah? For some of you, they'll have to skin you, wrap you, and freeze your ass before you ever learn anything. Yeah? And I want you to know you're looking at the biggest turkey of them all. And I rambled around out there, and everything that happened to me could happen, that happens to people like me. Now, my father told me to get out of his house. I didn't like his rules. He said, go somewhere and live by your own rules. And I got out of his house. I got a job with the Louisville Nashville Railroad up there. When I was 20, I moved out of my father's house, got me a nice apartment. After a period of time, I couldn't afford to pay the rent anymore, and I got me a one-room place. The next 3 or 4 years, I couldn't afford a one-room place, and was living in a flop house. And after a period of time, I couldn't afford a flop house, and I went to live on the city streets of Louisville. And I was a wino on Skid Row in the city streets of Louisville for about 2 years, and still around that same corner. And there's nothing interesting about Skid Row. You live in almost an emotional vacuum. There's literally no kind of feeling anymore. You've lost all sense of anything that's good and decent. And you just wait for the events of tomorrow and wonder when the hell it's all going to end. But you can drink enough alcohol where it doesn't do anything for you. It physically deteriorated me. I couldn't work. I couldn't eat. And I became dehydrated and suffering from malnutrition. And as I lived on that Skid Row, it's just a horrible place. There was a hardware store there. They threw out cardboard cartons. It was the days before the density dumpsters. And you could get over there and get one of them big freezer boxes that freezers came in, and you could lay down in those things. And we drug them over behind an L-shaped building, and we kind of had a cardboard condominium complex back there. And you can really be a snob wino if you got there early and saw some guy trying to curl up one of them old TV console boxes. You know, you knew you were better than he was. And look at him, and you ought to get rid of him. He's ruining the neighborhood type of a deal, you know. And it's just a senseless and hopeless place to live. I think if there's one thing you see in the eyes of Skid Row people, it's that sense of hopelessness. Webster says that if you have hope, you sincerely believe you will succeed tomorrow where you failed today. You have to believe that somewhere along the way things will be better. That is somebody who has hope. And on Skid Row, you don't find that. I know there's a lot of emotions that run through the human body of loneliness and frustration and despair, but if there's one thing that grips all people on Skid Row, it's that sense of hopelessness. I was out in California here a while back, and I went out to visit with Keith and Sue Drum for a while, and the kids he helps out there asked me to stay over on a Sunday night, and so I stayed over, and they sponsor an AA meeting on Skid Row in Los Angeles one night a month, and they wanted me to go with them, and I stayed over and went down to Skid Row in L.A. with them, And I was ever so glad that I did. And there was a tremendous amount of people there. I don't really know how many, but it was a vast amount of people. And I'm sitting there looking at these people on Skid Row with the memories of my own life and where I came from, you know. And I saw that. You know, I saw that in their eyes, that sense of utter hopelessness. And God, it's a destroying and a decaying thing in the minds of people, knowing that nothing ever, ever, ever again will be any better. Huh? And you become such an emotionless human being, it's not even depressing. It's just a stark fact and a realization that that's the way things are. And you can see it in those people. And they asked me to say something for about 10 minutes, and I talked and I told those guys and those gals, and, you know, that's what I could see. But I brought them good news. That when I came in AA, a man gave me a little pamphlet, and it was about Greek mythology. And it says in Greek mythology that at the gates of hell stands a three-headed dog called Cerebus. And Cerebus says, once you enter the gates of hell, never again will you be allowed to return to the land of hope. Once you enter the gates of hell, never again will you be allowed to return to the land of hope. But I said the good news is Greek mythology was written a long time before AA. You know, AA and its people say, I don't care how many times you've been to the gates of hell, and I don't care how far in you went when you got there, I'm here tonight to tell you that you will always be allowed to return to the land of hope once you come in the doors of this program, because it sits in front of you. If you get nothing else out of AA, you have to be looking at people with maybe just the slightest nudge in your brain that says, if they did it, maybe I can. And that's what AA has to offer Skid Row people. But I knew I'd die on Skid Row. I was thoroughly convinced of the fact that I was. My father had disowned me. I hadn't seen him or talked to him in ages. My sisters wanted nothing to do with me. I'd lost my job with the railroad. The only people I had were just like me. And you know, it was a days of desperation. I just didn't care anymore. I was sitting in the back room of a saloon out on that corner. I had some friends here from Louisville tonight who knows where it is. It was the Downs Cafe. And that corner was a hell of a corner. One time in Forbes magazine, it was rated the fifth roughest corner in the world from that racetrack environment. And I mean, it was bad news out there. And I loved every minute of it. It was just great fun. But, you know, I'm sitting in the back room of this saloon. The guy that owned it had let me in. I had a bottle of wine. And I'm sitting there. And the back door of this saloon opens the 21st day of August of 1962. And my father walked in with a man I had never seen before in my life. And I saw my father, and I was so ashamed. I hadn't seen my father in ages or talked to him in ages. And I didn't want him to see me looking like this, although I felt like maybe he knew. But I had long hair and a beard. I was filthy dirty. I suffered from malnutrition and dehydration, which caused you to bloat and change colors. You know, and all my teeth had been kicked out. I didn't have any teeth. I mean, I was just a pitiful looking piece of human flesh. And walked my father with this man. And I had never seen this man before in my life. And my father went over and sat on some stools that went around a lunch counter. And a man with him came to where I was sitting. Very distinguished looking gentleman. You know, tie and shirt and a tie and a suit on. Had silvery gray hair, and he always smiled. And he come over to, and he stuck his hand out, and he wanted to shake hands with me. How unusual. He said, hi, my name is Jack. I understand so is yours. And I said, yes. He said, I'm a friend of your father's, and I've heard about you through a vice president on the Louisville and Nashville Railroad Company. And he introduced me to your father, and I've talked with your father, and I've come out here to help you. He said, I hope you'll let me. I can't help you if you won't let me. Isn't that true with all of us? Nothing to do with Skid Row, but it has everything to do with you. I can't help you if you won't let me. And I was dumbfounded, you know. And I said, why? Why, stranger? I don't even know you. Why would you come here to a place like this to see somebody that looks like me? It makes no sense. He said, I've come because I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And that's why I'm here, he said. I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And that's why I'm here, he said. And that's why I'm here. And I go to 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week in the city of Lowell and have for years. There are 5 absolutes and sometimes others. And people say, why do you go? And I say, I go because I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me by my willingness to share that with you, it allows me to keep it. And my total happiness and serenity and peace of mind depends entirely upon my continuance to do that. And that's why I'm here. He said, I hope you'll come go with us. I've made arrangements to have you admitted to a psychiatric hospital in the city of Louisville. A friend of mine will admit you, he said, and perhaps we can get the show on the road to making your life better. I agreed to go because I was so sick. I asked him later if he mentioned AA. He didn't think so. I don't remember. He was a smart-ass old-timer. I said, you want me to go to a hospital looking like this? Why, he said, of course not. Do you have a place to change? Yeah. They were all alike. They still are. Yeah. But I got in that car, and my father had tears rolling down his eyes. My father told me later he could not believe the way that I looked. And he said to Jack, I hope to God whatever it is you're going to do works. And if it doesn't, I hope the good Lord sees fit to take him. I can't stand to see him ever again looking like this. And Jack said, well, he'll have the opportunity. So they took me to a psychiatric hospital. Now, that's all they had in 1962 in the state of Kentucky. They had an alcohol unit they had opened in 1961 in a state mental institution in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. There's a lady here tonight from Hopkinsville. And they put that alcoholic unit, one for men, one for women, in the grounds of that Western State Hospital in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. But it was the only place you could go in the state of Kentucky and be diagnosed as an alcoholic, whether you had insurance or not. Insurance companies and industry did not pay for the treatment of alcoholism. Even though you read all about the American Medical Association and what they did, it was never that much of an issue in those areas. And in the state of Indiana, right across the river in Madison, Indiana, a state hospital put in an alcohol unit. That was the only place there was to take an alcoholic like me at that time, unless you went to a psychiatric hospital. And he had me admitted there. Now, psychiatry at that time was wrong about us. And that's all I have to say on the subject. I am not critical of psychiatry. Psychiatry mistreated alcoholics. Not purposely. They honestly to God believed what they believed to be true about people like you and I. They just did not recognize alcoholism as a primary sickness. You suffered from a deep underlying emotional disorder of something else. You know. And I'm not so sure that they were wrong in that respect. Their treatment modality was wrong, but perhaps not their theory. Because all of my life it seemed like the most problems I had were sober. And all the people who crossed my path knew nothing about alcoholism because their threats were made what would happen to people like me if you don't quit drinking. My father said, if you don't quit drinking, get out of my house. My boss at the railroad said, if you don't quit drinking, get out of our property. The Catholic priest friend of ours said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to hell. The doctor said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. The policeman said, you're going to jail. The judge said, you're going to the penitentiary. All of these things are going to happen to me if I don't quit drinking. And nobody, until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, ever addressed the fact of what happens to people like me when I do quit drinking. It is the worst period of time in my life. I become so restless, irritable, and discontented. I want to be with them, doing what they do. And I can't go until I stay away long enough. I get so damn miserable, I'm back in it again. What happens to people like me when I quit drinking makes me experience the most miserable time of my life. And if you're a newcomer, I'm sure it does the same thing to you. The only blessing that took place in that time in my life was that I never married, and I never had any children, and I was a single wino who went to live in a city gutter. And it's the easiest way out of any alcoholic that ever lived. And I say that because I have seen, oh, so many of you who have loving families and children, and some of you children with parents. I've seen you go out and get a stinking, filthy gutter and take it home with you. I've seen some of the most filthy gutters in the world running down through the living rooms of some of the finest homes in the country. I've seen alcoholics in their sick minds, honestly to God, believing the people who loved them the most were in some way responsible for what they've become. And I've seen you reach out in those living room gutters and drag them through that stinking emotional mess of garbage that alcoholism breeds. And you teach them to be lonely and afraid and insecure and unloved and bitter. And you do it right in the middle of your own living rooms. Our friend Arbutus said this morning, just what in the hell is it that families don't know about alcoholism? Maybe they don't know how to puke. That's about it. But everything else they know, because we've taught them. And taught them well. And I never had to experience that. Single, childless, city gutters. Easy way out. Well, in that hospital I went, and a psychiatrist came to see me, was all confused about alcoholism. He really thought that all alcoholics suffered from a Valium deficiency. Really. He knew if we could get your Valium levels back to their proper place, you'd be okay. Long before General Electric knew you could live better electrically, they did. They'd hook them damn electrodes to your head and buzz you real good with them. They alleviated the depressive ruts of your mind. They came to a brilliant conclusion that alcoholics were depressed. You know, some of the things we do would depress a rhinoceros. But they would shock you, give you Valium. One of the dumbest things I remember they did, they wanted you to go to... I never heard of such a thing. Alcoholics go to group therapy alone. I'm serious. Who among you haven't been driving down the street in the car and have a committee meeting in there? You know, I think I'll stop in and get me. You better not go. Why? You know what happened last? Well, it'll be different this time, you know. We'll work things out just a little bit. It'll be okay, you know. You're having a hell of a running conversation and there ain't nobody there but you. You know, and that guy said, we're having group therapy. I went and got in the closet. That was silly. But he said, we are going to an AA meeting. And I cast that off and didn't really pay attention to it until I'd been in there a week and a nurse came into my room. And she said, Mr. Sullivan, and I said, yes. She said, tonight I want you to be here in this room at 7 o'clock because I'm coming and getting you and we're going to an AA meeting. I said, going to a what? She said, an AA meeting. I said, what in the hell is an AA meeting? She said, it's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you insinuating that you think I'm an alcoholic? She said, no, I'm not insinuating anything. I said, I'll have you know that I am no alcoholic. And she looked me straight in the eye and she said, I'll have you know that if you're not one, there ain't any. I said, well, I'm not going. And she said, oh, yes, you are. She said, you be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you in a room where the doorknobs are on the outside and the walls are padded. Now, if you've never been in a psychiatric institution, they have architectural defects. And some rooms have a door and the knob ain't on your side. I said, but I'm no damned alcoholic. Why would I tell her that? Skid Row has nothing to do with it. 17 years old has nothing to do with it. I told that nurse I was not an alcoholic because alcoholics are people who have problems they can't handle. Alcoholics are people who seemingly need to reach out into another dimension for the solution to their life. That's not me. Oh, I drink too much occasionally. Why? Because of them. If they'd leave me alone and I could get away from them, I'd be okay. Crazy? Hell yes, but I believed it. And I'm no damned alcoholic and I don't need to reach out there anymore. And she said, well, maybe you could be wrong about that. Isn't that an awful thing to tell an alcoholic? He could be wrong about that. Didn't know an alcoholic knew he was wrong. I never did in a long time. Yeah. Billy Miller told me another story. It's true. Of the great length, alcoholics will go to not to admit they're wrong. Billy's grandfather knew a cowboy out west that was an alcoholic. And he come out of a saloon one day, and an old man had ridden into town on a mule, and the cowboy waited to let old man get off that mule, and he's all drunk, and he went over to that old man, and he said, hey, old man, can you dance? The old man said, no, I don't know about dancing. Alcoholic cowboy said, but you can. Pulled his six-shooter out and started shooting at that old man's feet. That old man got to dancing, counting them bullets. And when that alcoholic fired that sixth bullet, that old man reached on the back of that mule and got a shotgun stuck in that alcoholic's face. He said, did you ever kiss a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. I mean, that's the length we'll go not to be wrong. What's wrong with me? I ain't no alcoholic. It ain't my fault. We go on this conversation for days. It ain't my fault. Billy Moore told me about a fella he knew one time that come down the street, and Billy said he saw him, and this guy had both of his ears burned. And Billy said to him, how in the name of God could a man burn both ears? He said, I went home last night and I was drunk. He said, my wife was ironing and the phone rang. He said, I reached over to get that phone and I picked up that damn iron and stuck it up my ear. And Billy said, well, that explains your right ear being burned. I said, how in the hell did you burn the left one? He said, that son of a bitch called back. That's a story to take home with you. Because if you got another one left in you, keep it in your pocket. And when somebody wants to know why, just tell them that guy called back. They won't know what in the hell you're talking about, but you will. Not your fault. But I said to that nurse, I'm not going to admit you. Yes, you are. You go padded cell, one doorknob, or the AA meeting. Well, she came and got me about 7 o'clock, and back a damn hallway we went, and I'm mad. Man, I was mad. I didn't want to go back there. I'd only been in there a week, but I'd fallen in love. I'd met a drunken woman in there, and God, she was a doll. Yeah. And there's nothing more interesting than two drunks that fall in love in a nut house. And I'm serious, if you go around them treatment centers and you see them drunks holding hands and they're blinking eyes at each other and they can't wait till they get out of there, and a lot of times they don't wait till they get out of there. The only thing I know that's dumber than that is somebody works in there, tries to separate them. Hey, I'm serious. If you work in one of them joints and you've got two drunks in love, you leave them alone. You encourage them to stay together. If you separate them, they'll screw up four people. They're just meant for each other. Well, my love was going square dance, and that nurse has got me by my ear, a 33-year-old macho drunk from 4th and Central, got me by my ear, taken me down a corridor to an AA meeting, and an old woman standing in the doorway. It was a student nurse's classroom. This nurse said to this old lady in the doorway, said, "Marguerite, this is Jack Sullivan. He wants to come to your AA meeting." I said, "I won't come to your damn AA meeting." She makes me come back here. And Marguerite smiled. She's a pretty gray-haired lady, about 60 years old. She was a doll. Put her arm on my shoulder and said, "Honey, come on now, honey. Calm down, honey. You'll enjoy this meeting. When you leave, you'll be glad you was here. Could I get you a cup of coffee and a cookie?" That a hell of a thing to offer a macho drunk from 4th and Central, a cup of coffee and a cookie. I mean, I've been in there a week and I'm feeling chirper. I was thinking about a half pint and a hooker. A cup of coffee and a cookie. Well, I went in and I sat down and some fool got up talking like I am tonight. And he wanted to share it with me, a story that I didn't want to hear. Took absolutely no significance to it at all. He tried all of his life to live out there in that world from the time he was 16 years old to where he could find some peace and contentment. He was in the search of serenity. He said he could become happy, joyous, and free, and he'd never had any of those, and he'd always would like to have had them. And his life was going to hell in a handbasket and had for many years, and he kept trying to do the same thing over and over and over again to control it. And he couldn't, and it damn near killed him. And finally somebody says, "I found a solution in my own life. Come on, go with me and I'll show it to you." It's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Just go. You don't have to stay if you don't want to. And he said, I went with him. And I decided to stay long enough until it affected my brain to where I wanted to stay. And he said, my life's been tremendously different since that time. And I'll tell you a little bit about it, he said. And then he sat down. I couldn't relate to that. I was interrupting him, making an ass out of myself you wouldn't believe. And they were trying to, you know, being nice and trying to shut you up. And when the meeting was over, I tried to get out that door and that old woman wouldn't let me. And she's standing at that doorway grinning, put her arm around my shoulder and called me honey. You know, and I'd heard them stories about old women and young boys. I wasn't no fool. Yeah. She said, honey, I hope you enjoyed yourself. And I hope you come back next week. She said, Alcoholics Anonymous needs people like you. I thought they ought to put that old broad in a home somewhere and get her off the street. Yeah. Well, they made me go back the following week. I didn't have any choice. And back I went and sit down next to some old man. I had absolutely no idea that night that man would change my life. I saw him there the week before and never before. I didn't speak to him that night and had no intention of speaking to him the second night. I had no idea that that man was about to change my life. But I went in and I sat down next to him. He was a grumpy old fool. He looked at me and he said, how you doing, boy? I don't like him calling me boy. And I didn't think it was really any of his damn business I was doing. He didn't work there. I'd seen him there the week before. I thought, well, you ought to be nice to him. He's an old man. I really think you ought to be nice to old people today. I really do. I said, I'm all right, old man, but I ain't no damn alcoholic. He said, really? I said, really. My doctor makes me come back here. Oh, he does. I said, yes, and I'm no damned alcoholic. Now, and a dead giveaway sitting there talking to him, you know, after about a week or two. I could thread a sewing machine while it was running. He said, you're not an alcoholic? I said, you better believe I ain't no alcoholic. And he said, well, let me tell you something. You ought to ask your doctor tomorrow what you are. And when he tells you what you are, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell. Well, I got up, moved away from him. And there was a guy sitting up behind that desk, was a gentle fella named Jim Krishan. I've always said in AA, get two sponsors. Get an ass kicker and a soul saver. And I had one of each. And Jim would just laugh when that old man get after me. I'd go back over the following week and sit down. He said, "You talking to me?" I said, "Oh, yeah, you're okay, I guess." He said, "Oh, yeah, I'm okay, I guess." He said, "You know why I enjoy talking to you?" And I said, "I have no idea." He said, "I used to be just like you. Arrogant, defiant, smart aleck punk. Used to be just like you." He said, "You remind me of myself when I was young." I said, "If I could get you out of here, I'd remind you out of yourself, old man, you know." And I went back the fourth week, and I stayed there for 4 weeks, and they transferred me to that mental hospital in Western State Hospital in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which was an experience of itself. You know, I really don't know my feelings about it at that time, but I have a tremendous amount of compassion today for people in mental institutions. You know, how blessed we are. We say, "But for the grace of God," you know, and always in our lives, "But for the grace of God" is not a spiritual theory. It's an actual fact. We constantly see that in our lives if we have enough sense to take advantage of it. And here were some people in that mental institution who are biochemically insane. They have some kind of a screw-up or a mix-up in brain chemistry which does not allow them ever again to return to the land of reality. And sometimes medication helps them and sometimes it don't. But they have a lot of problems with it. And we're blessed. That's not the type of insanity you and I suffer from. And my old sponsor told me about that later on down the road. You know? But it was not a very nice experience because they didn't want you there. The mental patients didn't like drunks. And if you go in a mental hospital with low self-esteem, and you're hearing a bunch of people who are residents there talking about you, it doesn't do much for that. I'm serious, you know, they're saying, "Well, what do you think about them drunks coming down here, Martha? I don't know why they brought them here. Bunch of damn troublemakers. My uncle was a drunk. Trouble, trouble, trouble. That's all they are. I wish the hell they'd take them someplace else." Now, and that just don't do much for your self-esteem when those kind of people are talking about you. But I stayed there for 40 days. My attitude didn't change much. Had a guy that tried to help me. Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most fascinating organizations ever in the existence of the world. And I think it's that way because everybody who crosses our path teaches us something. And most of the time, if it's an adversary in their life, it's something that brings gratitude into our lives. And I'm sitting there talking to a guy who had a cast on his leg. And he said, "Jack, you're a very bitter young man." You know, and he said, "To be absolutely honest, we have a very nasty attitude. But can't anybody talk to you? You won't listen to anybody. And when you're like that, you'll always be the same. Nothing changes till you change, and you're not willing to change." And he said, "I don't want to tell you anything about you. I'm telling you about what you ought to do. Let me tell you a little bit about myself." He said, "I had a very large insurance company in Louisville, Kentucky. When you get home, ask people in AA if they know James Moynier." And he said, "I was a wealthy man. And I drank it away. And I lost a beautiful family, 2 children, a wife. And I hit the bottoms. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stayed sober and was very active in their program. And I got my agency back. And I got my family back. And I got my house back. And I got too busy for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I joined that Martini for Lunch bunch." And he said, "I lost my family. And I lost my home. I lost my agency. And I fell drunk and broke my leg. And here I sit." And he said, "What I'm trying to tell you is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that will salvage the rest of your life for you to make something good and decent out of it if you listen to the people who are trying to help you." And I got up and walked away. I didn't want to hear it. I'm out of that hospital 6 weeks. I'm at an AA meeting at Preston and Broadway on Saturday night, and halfway through that meeting, you hear sirens and police cars, and I mean, it was wild. It was right outside the doors of that meeting, and my old sponsor says, "Go out there and see what the hell's going on." And I went out there, and out in the middle of that street laid a dead man, and it was James Moynier. He was dead in the middle of Preston Street in Louisville, Kentucky, drunk, trying to come to that AA meeting. I told that story one night in one of my talks, and I noticed a lady in the audience with tears in her eyes. It was his daughter. And she came up to me later and wanted to know a lot about her father, and I had the pleasure of talking at a few of her AA birthdays. She felt sober. And that taught me a valuable lesson. I didn't want to hear it. But anyway, I left there and I came back to Louisville. My father came down and got me and brought me back to live with a sister of mine who I'd lived with before. And my sister asked me if I'd start drinking, would I leave? And I said, yes, I'll go. And I believe I would have. But my father said to me, I'll be out here Monday to pick you up and get you some decent clothes. And Tuesday night, we're going to get something to eat. And I'm going to take you up to Our Lady of Peace Hospital and Hillary will bring you home. I said, how in the hell do you know Hillary? He said, don't worry about it. I said, man, what do you know Hillary Sanders? He said, I know him, and don't worry about it. He's going to ride you home. So I went, and Hillary brought me home. I said, how you know my father? He said, none of your damn business how I know your father. But he said, I want you out here in this driveway tomorrow night at 7 o'clock because George Spencer will pick you up and take you to an AA meeting. And I was out there that night, and George dropped me off and said, he wants you out here in his driveway tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. He'll show him back. He's going to pick you up and take you to an AA meeting. I was out there that night, and Leo dropped me off and said, you be out here in his driveway tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And Hillary, I said, what in the hell? Is that all you think I have to do when you're first sober, you're busy. I have things to catch up on. Leo said, tell Hillary he'll be here tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. I thought, I'll tell him. So he wheeled in that driveway, and I wheeled out that door, and I said, listen, Hillary, I can't go with you tonight. I've got to get, he said, get in the car. I said, I cannot go with you tonight. He said, get in the car. I said, you're not listening to me. I have to be, and he opened the door, and he got out, and he said, I am not telling you again. Get in the damn car. I got in that damn car 366 days the first year I was sober. I thought the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous was get in the car. People ask me today, how do you stay sober? I said, don't drink, go to me, get in the car. People I sponsor say, get in the damn car and I'll see you outside or something. And it works. It works. So I started running with those guys and going with those guys, still defiant as hell. And the interesting thing about those old guys, and I'm the same way, you know, when they got to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which changes all of our lives, and don't be afraid, I'm not going through all 12 of them. Don't become restless there, don't discontent at them. They would tell you about them, and I'm the same way with people I spun. Hillary said, you read the first step of AA? And I said, yeah, let me tell you about me. He said, you know, it took me a while to admit I was powerless over alcohol. You know, I always thought that meant every time I drank it, I got drunk. And he said, I didn't get drunk every time I drank it, but every time I drank it, I got in trouble. And every time I was in trouble, it was due to my drinking. And he said, little did I realize the powerlessness that I had over alcohol was where it made me go. I didn't go anywhere where it wasn't. I didn't stay anywhere where it wasn't. It took me there, and it made me stay. And when I drank it, and I got in trouble, it was due to the drinking. And the unmanageability of my life was when I was sober. I was so damn miserable. And he said, for a long time, I couldn't see that. And one day, that made sense to me. He said, I couldn't drink it. When I did, I generally got in trouble. It took me everywhere I went. And it was such an unmanageable thing in my life because without it, I was nothing. I was literally nothing. And he said, a fellow told me one day I would have to find a power that was greater than me, and that could have been anybody. I said, I've wondered about that. Just where in the hell do you find a power that's greater than you that you come to believe in? He said, you're talking to him. I said, I understand that. Yeah. Restore me to sanity? You think I'm crazy? He said, in what degree? didn't you just come back from a mental institution? I said, yeah. He said, do you think you're as crazy in the manner those people are? Some biochemical insanity? No way. The insanity in your life is because of your total and complete dishonesty as to what and who you are. You're insane because you can't see yourself for what you are. And I couldn't see myself for what I was. And it took people with intent and purpose of doing me favors to make me understand. They saw what I was. But I was so damn dishonest, I couldn't see me for what I was. And you want to get sane in Alcoholics Anonymous? Get honest. And he said, I'll tell you something. The day they bury you, whatever degree of sanity you have been able to attain, you will have the same degree of honesty. You will be as sane as you are honest. And I said, well, there's no sense in pursuing this any further, that I'm not making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God because I don't believe in God. And he didn't answer me. I said, did you hear what I said? Yeah, I heard what you said. What did I say? He said you don't believe in God. Well, what about it? What do you mean, what about it? I don't give a damn what you believe in. I said, well, how about God? He said, he cares less than I do. He said, don't you understand? Don't you understand nothing? You haven't got anything going for you in this program except for the simple fact that I believe in you. You want to know something else? So does God. God believes if you won't drink, go to meetings, get in the car, you'll be all right. And so do I. And the only thing you've got going for you, newcomer, is that I believe in you and God believes in you. And that's all you need right now. And if you stay here long enough, you will see that you will learn to believe in me and you will learn to believe in God. And when that happens in your life, you're on your way. But as far as you not giving your will to him, for God's sake, find somebody to give it to. He said, what about your garbage man? He nice fella? Are you crazy? Well, he said, you've had control of it for the last 33 years, and look where in the hell it took you. Give it to somebody. You're not doing very good with it. How do you argue with that? Yeah? How do you argue with that? You don't argue with it. Those people taught me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that's built on a foundation of basically of a Scandinavian triangle. And the base of that triangle is recovery, its foundation is recovery, and the sidebars of it is unity and service. And Hillary said to me that in your life is built on a triangle, and the foundation of it is Almighty God, and the sidebars are you and other people. And you will learn to love because that love flows from God to people to you and back to God. And you learn to love in a manner that Alcoholics Anonymous teaches you that you're probably very unfamiliar with. Men love men, women love women, simply because we're better people because of each other. I don't love you for what you are. Not at all. I love you for what I am when I'm with you. You see, because of you, I'm a better person. Maybe in some small way because of me, you're a better person. But there's one thing for sure. Because of each other, we're all better people. And how could we not love each other for that? You know? How could we not love each other for that? He made me look at myself and make the restitutions. He told me my defects of character were the very, very things that caused me to do things that I shouldn't have done, to say things I shouldn't have said, and to think things I shouldn't have thought. And he said, my shortcomings were the simple things of things that I should have done and didn't do, and the things that I should have said and didn't, and the things I should have thought and didn't. And he told me when the day came in my life that I had a spiritual awakening, would be the day that I realized that somebody else lives on this planet besides me. And you will create a working relationship with Almighty God and other people and a recognition of your own capabilities. And you'll do what you can, you'll get people to help you and accept the things that you can through the grace of God. And that if I was looking for a God that I could understand, his was the simple fact that he believed that God was the intangible spirit of truth that lived in the hearts of people. And the truth was something I couldn't handle. The truth was my killer. I couldn't see me for what I was. In the Phantom of the Opera, there's a verse that describes my life. When the Phantom is singing to the girl in the opera, he says, "Close your eyes, for your eyes will only see the truth. And the truth isn't what you want to see. In the darkness, it's easy to pretend that the truth is what it ought to be." My life, the truth is what it ought to be. I stayed with that old man, and I stayed with guys like Wino Gill, and I stayed with guys like Paul Keibler, you know, and they taught me the basic, simplistic things of life. They were not complicated, and neither do I. And I don't have the intelligence to be if I wanted to be. Jack Knox, founded Alcoholics Anonymous in Nashville, Tennessee, died with 50-some-odd years of sobriety. The last words Jack Knox ever told me, the last night I ever saw him when he was still alive, he said to me when he was putting on his coat to go out the door of a club in Nashville, he said, "Son, you want to have a good life? Keep your rabies list clean." I said, "What in the hell are you talking about?" He said, "That's all you ever have to worry about as long as you live. Keep your rabies list clean." He said, "When I was still drinking, I ran out of whiskey one day and I went down to the liquor store to get some on the way home. A dog bit me. And the neighbor saw it and called the police, and the police couldn't find the dog, and they came to my apartment and told me they couldn't find that dog and I'd have to take rabies shots." He said, "I ran the cops off and told them, 'Get out of my house. I ain't taking any damn rabies shots.' And I sit there drinking my whiskey thinking, 'What am I going to do if I got rabies?'" He said, "I got a tablet out of my desk drawer and a pencil, and I wrote down the names of everybody I was going to bite." He said, "I filled up 2 pages, and I thought, in all fairness, I ought to write down the names of people who, if they had rabies, they'd want to bite me. And I filled up another 2 pages. He said, "Jack, I've been sober going on now 50 years. And he said, "In the last 30 years, I have not suffered from any self-inflicted wounds. I don't do anything to hurt me," he said. "And the only thing I need to know if my life is in order that every day I ask myself, 'Is your rabies list clean?'" He said, "Jack, if I had rabies tonight, I can't think of a soul I'd want to bite." And he said, "I honestly to God have not done anything to any human being or Almighty God to give them any reason to want to bite me." He put his coat on and his hat and cold night in Nashville and started out the door. And I did not know at that time I'd never see him again. But he looked, turned around, and he smiled. And he said, "Remember, boy, keep your rabies list clean and you'll be okay." Kind of simple, you know, but that's the kind of AA I had, and that's the kind of AA I needed. I sober 13 months when I married Gay, and my sponsor centered Al-Anon, so she's been a black belt Al-Anon for the past 34 years. And Hillary insisted that the Al-Anon family groups teach people how to live in a dimension of their own, as AA teaches us how to live in a dimension of our own, to where we mold that together in a dimension of ours. She's herself, I'm me, and we're each other. She lives her life, I live mine, we live ours. She does her thing, I do mine, we do ours. And many of y'all know me, I don't go anywhere without her. I just never have believed in, please believe me, it's got nothing to do with anybody except me. There's nobody home but us two, and I just do not believe in traveling and leaving her home. So wherever you see me, she's with me. I love her very much, and I do not intend to ever leave her home if she wants to go. You know, and that's the way our life has been. We do well. Got my job back with that railroad. 1974, I started an alcohol and drug abuse program for them. And loved every minute of it. Traveled in 13 states, put it together, a tremendous package, had a hell of a good job. Merged with the Seaboard Coastline down here in Jacksonville. Their director was an alcoholic named Thad Walker. A lot of y'all may know Thad. Him and I worked together beautifully, and Thad retired, and and then we were taken over by another corporation, and their program was based on psychiatric social work theories, and I couldn't hack that, and they couldn't hack me, and so I retired. And I retired in 1988, and I don't do nothing, and I'm damn good at it. I follow the philosophy of old Bum Phillips, the Houston Oilers football coach. Somebody said to Bum, what do you do since you've retired? He said, I don't do nothing. And I start that at noon. I start that at noon, you know. And so it's been a great, great life. I just love every minute of it. And having an opportunity like this for Gay and I to come down and see a friend like Sharon and our Brutus again, and it's just great. And meeting some of you and some old friends like Dick and a lot of y'all that I've known over the years, and don't get a chance to see you, things like this, is just so rewarding, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And my life is fulfilled. You know, it really is. And it's all because of you and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll close by telling you a story that I like to close my AA talks with. It meant a lot to me when I heard it many, many years ago. It was about a man who was walking out of a very cold and lonely road one night. In the middle of the road laid a snake. And when the man passed the snake spoke to him. And the snake said, Mister, please help me. It's bitterly cold out here, and I cannot live in this kind of weather. If you leave me on the road, I'll die. Please pick me up and put me under your coat and get me warm in order that I may live. And the man said, I can't do that. You're a poisonous reptile, and surely if I got you warm and restored you to vitality, you would bite me. And the snake said, I wouldn't bite you if you saved my life. And the man thought for a minute, and he picked the snake up and put him under his coat. And when the snake got warm, he bit him, and the man grabbed the snake and threw him back to the road. And he looked at the snake, and he said, I thought you promised if I'd help you not to bite me. And with a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked at him and said, you knew what I was when you picked me up. My friends, if you're ever somewhere in the confines of your own home, a cocktail lounge, a bar, wherever it may be, if it's your decision to take the cap off of the bottle or the cork out of the jug, rationalize it to those who want to listen. Try to explain it to those who are willing to hear. But if you've been here, if you know me, if you've met us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me in Orlando.